Finally, he visits his parents' house and is shaken to the core. His parents claim that they have never seen him before and that they never had a son. Without friends, family, or a home, he drifts aimlessly around town, eventually falling asleep on a park bench like a homeless man. When he wakes up the next day, he finds himself comfortably back in bed with his wife. However, when his wife turns around, he is shocked to find that she is not his wife at all, but a strange woman that he has never seen before. Are such preposterous stories possible? Perhaps. If the protagonist in The Twilight Zone had asked some revealing questions of his mother, he might have found out that she had a miscarriage and hence never had a son. Sometimes a single cosmic ray, a single particle from outer space, can strike deep in the DNA within an embryo and cause a mutation that will eventually lead to a miscarriage. In such a case, a single quantum event can separate two worlds, one in which you live as a normal, productive citizen, and another that is exactly identical, except that you were never born. To slip between these worlds is within the laws of physics, but it is extremely unlikely. The probability of it happening is astronomically small. But as you can see, the quantum theory gives us a picture of the universe much stranger than the one given to us by Einstein. In relativity, the stage of life on which we perform may be made of rubber, with the actors traveling in curved paths as they move across the set. As in Newton's world, the actors in Einstein's world parrot their lines from a script that was written beforehand. But in a quantum play, the actors suddenly throw away the script and act on their own. The puppets cut their strings. Free will has been established. The actors may disappear and reappear from the stage. Even stranger, they may find themselves appearing in two places at the same time. The actors, when delivering their lines, never know for sure whether or not they are speaking to someone who might suddenly disappear and reappear in another place. Monster Mind, John Wheeler. Except perhaps for Einstein and Bohr, no man has wrestled more with the absurdities and successes of the quantum theory than John Wheeler. Is all physical reality just an illusion? Do parallel quantum universes exist? In the past, when he was not mulling over these intractable quantum paradoxes, Wheeler was applying these probabilities to build the atomic and hydrogen bombs and was pioneering the study of black holes. John Wheeler is the last of the giants, or monster minds, as his student Richard Feynman once called them, who have grappled with the insane conclusions of the quantum theory. It was Wheeler who coined the term black hole in 1967 at a conference at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City after the discovery of the first pulsars. Wheeler was born in 1911 in Jacksonville, Florida. His father was a librarian, but engineering was in his family's blood. Three of his uncles were mining engineers and often used explosives in their work. The idea of using dynamite fascinated him, and he loved to watch explosions. One day, he was carelessly experimenting with a piece of dynamite, and it accidentally exploded in his hand, blowing off part of his thumb and the end of one finger. Coincidentally, when Einstein was a college student, a similar explosion took place in his hand due to carelessness, requiring several stitches. Wheeler was a precocious kid, mastering calculus and devouring every book he could find on the new theory that his friends were buzzing about, quantum mechanics. Right before his eyes, a new theory was being developed in Europe by Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, and Erwin Schrödinger that suddenly unlocked the secrets of the atom. Only a few years before, followers of the philosopher Ernst Mach had scoffed at the existence of atoms, stating that atoms had never been observed in the laboratory and probably were a fiction. What couldn't be seen probably did not exist, they claimed. The great German physicist Ludwig Boltzmann, who laid down the laws of thermodynamics, committed suicide in 1906, in part because of the intense ridicule he faced while promoting the concept of atoms. Then, in a few momentous years, from 1925 to 1927, the secrets of the atom came tumbling out. Never in modern history, except for the year 1905 with the work of Einstein, had breakthroughs of this magnitude been accomplished in so short a time. Wheeler wanted to be part of this revolution, but he realized that the United States was in the backwash of physics. There was not a single world-class physicist among its ranks. Like J. Robert Oppenheimer before him, Wheeler left the United States and journeyed to Copenhagen to learn from the master himself, Niels Bohr. Previous experiments on electrons demonstrated that they acted both as a particle and as a wave. This strange duality between particles and waves was finally unraveled by the quantum physicists. The electron, in its dance around the atom, was shown to be a particle, but it was accompanied by a mysterious wave. In 1925, Austrian physicist Erwin Schrödinger proposed an equation, the celebrated Schrödinger wave equation, that accurately described the motion of the wave that accompanies the electron. This wave, represented by the Greek letter psi, gave breathtakingly precise predictions for the behavior of atoms, which sparked a revolution in physics. Suddenly, almost from first principles, one could peer inside the atom itself to calculate how electrons danced in their orbits, making transitions and bonding atoms together in molecules. As quantum physicist Paul Dirac boasted, physics would soon reduce all of chemistry to mere engineering. He proclaimed, "The underlying physical laws necessary for the mathematical theory of a larger part of physics and the whole of chemistry are thus completely known, and the difficulty is only that the application of these laws leads to equations much too complicated to be soluble." As spectacular as this psi function was, it was still a mystery as to what it really represented. Finally, in 1928, physicist Max Born proposed the idea that this wave function represented the probability of finding the electron at any given point. In other words, you could never know for sure precisely where an electron was. All you could do was calculate its wave function, which told you the probability of it being there. So, if atomic physics could be reduced to waves of probability of an electron being here or there, and if an electron could seemingly be in two places at the same time, how do we finally determine where the electron really is? Bohr and Heisenberg eventually formulated the complete set of recipes in a quantum cookbook that has worked beautifully in atomic experiments with magnificent precision. The wave function only tells you the probability that the electron is located here or there. If the wave function is large at a certain point, it means that there is a high likelihood that the electron is located there. If it is small there, then it is unlikely that the electron can be found there. For example, if we could see the wave function of a person, it would look remarkably like the person himself. However, the wave function also gently seeps out into space, meaning that there is a small probability that the person can be found on the moon. In fact, the person's wave function actually spreads out throughout the universe. This also means that the wave function of a tree can tell you the probability that it is either standing or falling, but it cannot definitively tell you in which state it actually is. But common sense tells us that objects are in definite states. When you look at a tree, the tree is definitely in front of you. It is either standing or fallen, but not both. To resolve the discrepancy between waves of probability and our common sense notion of existence, Bohr and Heisenberg assumed that after a measurement is made by an outside observer, the wave function magically collapses, and the electron falls into a definite state. That is, after looking at the tree, we see that it is truly standing. In other words, the process of observation determines the final state of the electron. Observation is vital to existence. After we look at the electron, its wave function collapses, so the electron is now in a definite state, and there is no more need for wave functions. So the postulates of Bohr's Copenhagen school, loosely speaking, can be summarized as follows. A. All energy occurs in discrete packets, called quanta. The quantum of light, for example, is the photon. The quanta of the weak force are called the W and Z boson. The quantum for the strong force is called the gluon. And the quantum for gravity is called the graviton, which has yet to be seen in the laboratory. B. Matter is represented by point particles, but the probability of finding the particle is given by a wave. The wave, in turn, obeys a specific wave equation, such as Schrödinger's wave equation. C. Before an observation is made, an object exists in all possible states simultaneously. To determine which state the object is in, we have to make an observation, which collapses the wave function, and the object goes into a definite state. The act of observation destroys the wave function, and the object now assumes a definite reality. The wave function has served its purpose. It has given us the precise probability of finding the object in that particular state. Determinism or uncertainty? The quantum theory is the most successful physical theory of all time. The highest formulation of the quantum theory is the Standard Model, which represents the fruits of decades of experiments with particle accelerators. Parts of this theory have been tested to one part in 10 billion. If one includes the mass of the neutrino, then the Standard Model is consistent with all experiments on subatomic particles, without exception. But no matter how successful the quantum theory is, experimentally it is based on postulates that have unleashed storms of philosophical and theological controversy for the past 80 years. The second postulate in particular has raised the ire of religions because it asks who decides our fate. Throughout the ages, philosophers, theologians, and scientists have been fascinated by the future and whether somehow our destinies are knowable. In Shakespeare's Macbeth, Banquo, desperate to lift the veil that clouds our destiny, delivers the memorable lines, "If you can look into the seeds of time, and say which grain will grow and which will not, speak then to me." Act 1, Scene 3. Shakespeare wrote these words in 1606. 80 years later, another Englishman, Isaac Newton, had the audacity to claim that he knew the answer to this ancient question. Both Newton and Einstein believed in the concept called determinism, which states that all future events can be determined in principle. To Newton, the universe was a gigantic clock wound up by God at the beginning of time. Ever since then, it's been ticking, obeying his three laws of motion in a precisely predictable way. The French mathematician Pierre-Simon de Laplace, who was a scientific advisor to Napoleon, wrote that using Newton's laws, one could predict the future with the same precision that one views the past. He wrote that if a being could know the position and velocity of all the particles in the universe, for such an intellect nothing could be uncertain, and the future, just like the past, would be present before his eyes. When Laplace presented Napoleon with a copy of his masterwork, Celestial Mechanics, the emperor said, "You have written this huge work on the heavens without once mentioning God." Laplace replied, "Sire, I had no need of that hypothesis." To Newton and Einstein, the notion of free will, that we are masters of our destiny, was an illusion. This common-sense notion of reality, that concrete objects that we touch are real and exist in definite states, Einstein called objective reality, he most clearly presented his position as follows. I am a determinist, compelled to act as if free will existed, because if I wish to live in a civilized society, I must act responsibly. I know philosophically a murderer is not responsible for his crimes, but I prefer not to take tea with him. My career has been determined by various forces over which I have no control, primarily those mysterious glands in which nature prepares the very essence of life. Henry Ford may call it his inner voice. Socrates referred to it as his demon. Each man explains in his own way the fact that human will is not free. Everything is determined by forces over which we have no control, for the insect as well as for the star. Human beings, vegetables, or cosmic dust, we all dance to a mysterious time, intoned in the distance by an invisible player. Theologians have also wrestled with this question. Most religions of the world believe in some form of predestination, the idea that God is not only omnipotent, all-powerful, and omnipresent, exists everywhere, but also omniscient, knows everything, even the future. In some religions, this means that God knows whether we will go to heaven or hell even before we are born. In essence, there is a book of destiny somewhere in heaven with all of our names listed, including our birth date, our failures and triumphs, our joys and our defeats, even our death date, and whether we will live in paradise or eternal damnation. This delicate theological question of predestination in part helped to split the Catholic Church in half in 1517, when Martin Luther tacked the 95 Theses on the Church at Wittenberg. In it, he attacked the Church's practice of selling indulgences, essentially bribes that paved the journey to heaven for the rich. Perhaps Luther seemed to say, God does know our future ahead of time, and our fates are predestined, but God cannot be persuaded to change his mind by our making a handsome donation to the Church. But to physicists who accept the concept of probability, the most controversial postulate by far is the third postulate, which has given headaches to generations of physicists and philosophers. Observation is a loose, ill-defined concept. Moreover, it relies on the fact that there are actually two types of physics, one for the bizarre subatomic world, where electrons can seemingly be in two places at the same time, and the other for the macroscopic world that we live in, which appears to obey the common-sense laws of Newton. According to Bohr, there is an invisible wall separating the atomic world from the everyday, familiar, macroscopic world. While the atomic world obeys the bizarre rules of the quantum theory, we live out our lives outside that wall, in the world of well-defined planets and stars, where the waves have already collapsed. Wheeler, who learned quantum mechanics from its creators, liked to summarize the two schools of thought on this question. He gives the example of three umpires at a baseball game discussing the finer points of baseball. In making a decision, the three umpires say, Number one, I calls 'em like I see 'em. Number two, I calls 'em the way they are. Number three, they ain't nothing till I calls 'em. To Wheeler, the second umpire is Einstein, who believed there was an absolute reality outside human experience. Einstein called this objective reality, the idea that objects can exist in definite states without human intervention. The third umpire is Bohr, who argued that reality existed only after an observation was made. Trees in the Forest. Physicists sometimes view philosophers with a certain disdain, quoting from the Roman Cicero, who once said, There is nothing so absurd that it has not been said by philosophers. The mathematician Stanislaus Ulam, who took a dim view of giving lofty names to silly concepts, once said, "Madness is the ability to make fine distinctions on different kinds of nonsense." Einstein himself once wrote of philosophy, "Is not all of philosophy as if written in honey? It looks wonderful when one contemplates it, but when one looks again, it is all gone. Only mush remains." Physicists also like to tell the apocryphal story supposedly told by a university president who became exasperated looking at the budget for the physics, math, and philosophy departments. He supposedly said, "Why is it that you physicists always require so much expensive equipment? Now the Department of Mathematics requires nothing but money for paper, pencils, and waste paper baskets, and the Department of Philosophy is better still. It doesn't even ask for waste paper baskets." However, philosophers may yet get the last laugh. The quantum theory is incomplete and rests on shaky philosophical grounds. This quantum controversy forces one to re-examine the works of philosophers like Bishop Berkeley, who in the 18th century claimed that objects exist only because humans are there to observe them, a philosophy called solipsism or idealism. If a tree falls in the forest, but no one is there to see it, then it does not really fall, they claim. Now we have a quantum reinterpretation of trees falling in the forest. Before an observation is made, you don't know whether it has fallen or not. In fact, the tree exists in all possible states simultaneously. It might be burnt, fallen, firewood, sawdust, and so on. Once an observation is made, then the tree suddenly springs into a definite state, and we see that it has fallen, for instance. Comparing the philosophical difficulty of relativity and the quantum theory, Feynman once remarked, "There was a time when the newspapers said that only 12 men understood the theory of relativity. I do not believe there was ever such a time. On the other hand, I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics." He writes that quantum mechanics describes nature as absurd from the point of view of common sense, and it fully agrees with experiment. So I hope you can accept nature as she is, absurd. This has created an uneasy feeling among many practicing physicists, who feel as if they are creating entire worlds based on shifting sands. Steven Weinberg writes, "I admit to some discomfort in working all my life in a theoretical framework that no one fully understands." In traditional science, the observer tries to keep as dispassionately detached from the world as possible. As one wag said, "You can always spot the scientist at a strip club because he is the only one examining the audience." But now, for the first time, we see that it is impossible to separate the observer from the observed. As Max Planck once remarked, "Science cannot solve the ultimate mystery of nature, and it is because in the last analysis we ourselves are part of the mystery we are trying to solve." The cat problem. Erwin Schrödinger, who introduced the wave equation in the first place, thought that this was going too far. He confessed to Bohr that he regretted ever proposing the wave concept if it introduced the concept of probability into physics. To demolish the idea of probabilities, he proposed an experiment. Imagine a cat sealed in a box. Inside the box, there is a bottle of poison gas connected to a hammer, which in turn is connected to a Geiger counter placed near a piece of uranium. No one disputes that the radioactive decay of the uranium atom is purely a quantum event that cannot be predicted ahead of time. Let's say there is a 50% chance that a uranium atom will decay in the next second. But if a uranium atom decays, it sets off the Geiger counter, which sets off the hammer that breaks the glass, killing the cat. Before you open the box, it is impossible to tell whether the cat is dead or alive. In fact, in order to describe the cat, physicists add the wave function of the live cat and the dead cat, That is, we put the cat in a nether world of being 50% dead and 50% alive, simultaneously. Now open the box. Once we peer into the box, an observation is made. The wave function collapses, and we see that the cat is, say, alive. To Schrödinger, this was silly. How can a cat be both dead and alive at the same time, just because we haven't looked at it? Does it suddenly spring into existence as soon as we observe it? Einstein was also displeased with this interpretation. Whenever guests came over to his house, he would say, "Look at the moon. Does it suddenly spring into existence when a mouse looks at it?" Einstein believed the answer was no, but in some sense the answer might be yes. Things finally came to a head in 1930 in a historic clash at the Solvay conference between Einstein and Bohr. Wheeler would later remark that it was the greatest debate in intellectual history that he knew about. In 30 years, he had never heard of a debate between two greater men on a deeper issue with deeper consequences for an understanding of the universe. Einstein, always bold, daring, and supremely eloquent, proposed a barrage of thought experiments to demolish the quantum theory. Bohr, who mumbled incessantly, was reeling after each attack. Physicist Paul Ehrenfest observed, "It was wonderful for me to be present at the dialogues between Bohr and E. E, like a chess player with ever new examples, a kind of perpetuum mobile of the second kind, intent on breaking through uncertainty. Bohr, always out of a cloud of philosophical smoke, seeking the tools for destroying one example after another. Einstein, like a jack-in-the-box, popping up fresh every morning. Oh, it was delightful. But I am almost unreservedly pro-Bohr and contra-E. He now behaves toward Bohr exactly as the champions of absolute simultaneity had behaved toward him." Finally, Einstein proposed an experiment that he thought would give the coup de grace to the quantum theory. Imagine a box containing a gas of photons. If the box has a shutter, it can briefly release a single photon. Since one can measure the shutter speed precisely, and also measure the photon's energy, one can therefore determine the state of the photon with infinite precision, thereby violating the uncertainty principle. Ehrenfest wrote, "To Bohr this was a heavy blow. At the moment he saw no solution. He was extremely unhappy all through the evening, walked from one person to another, trying to persuade them all that this could not be true, because if E was right, this would mean the end of physics. But he could think of no refutation. I will never forget the sight of the two opponents leaving the university club. Einstein, a majestic figure, walking calmly with a faintly ironical smile, and Bohr trotting along by his side, extremely upset." When Ehrenfest later encountered Bohr, he was speechless. All he could do was mumble the same word over and over again. "Einstein, Einstein, Einstein." The next day, after an intense, sleepless night, Bohr was able to find a tiny flaw in Einstein's argument. After emitting the photon, the box was slightly lighter, since matter and energy were equivalent. This meant that the box rose slightly under gravity, since energy has weight, according to Einstein's own theory of gravity. But this introduced uncertainty in the photon's energy. If one then calculated the uncertainty in the weight and uncertainty in the shutter speed, one found that the box obeyed the uncertainty principle exactly. In effect, Bohr had used Einstein's own theory of gravity to refute Einstein. Bohr had emerged victorious. Einstein was defeated. When Einstein later complained that God does not play dice with the world, Bohr reportedly fired back, "Stop telling God what to do." Ultimately, Einstein admitted that Bohr had successfully refuted his arguments. Einstein would write, "I am convinced that this theory undoubtedly contains a piece of definitive truth." Einstein, however, had disdain for physicists who failed to appreciate the subtle paradoxes inherent in the quantum theory. He once wrote, "Of course, today every rascal thinks he knows the answer, but he is deluding himself." After these and other fierce debates with quantum physicists, Einstein finally gave in, but took a different approach. He conceded that the quantum theory was correct, but only within a certain domain, only as an approximation to the real truth. In the same way that relativity generalized, but did not destroy, Newton's theory, he wanted to absorb the quantum theory into a more general, more powerful theory, the unified field theory. This debate between Einstein and Schrödinger on one side, and Bohr and Heisenberg on the other, cannot be easily dismissed, since these thought experiments can now be performed in the laboratory. Although scientists cannot make a cat appear both dead and alive, they can now manipulate individual atoms with nanotechnology. Recently, these mind-bending experiments were done with a buckyball containing 60 carbon atoms, so the wall envisioned by Bohr separating large objects from quantum objects is rapidly crumbling. Experimental physicists are now even contemplating what would be required to show that a virus, consisting of thousands of atoms, can be in two places at the same time. The bomb. Unfortunately, discussions over these delicious paradoxes were interrupted with the rise of Hitler in 1933 and the rush to build an atomic bomb. It was known for years, via Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, that there was a vast storehouse of energy locked in the atom. But most physicists poo-pooed the idea of ever being able to harness this energy. Even Ernest Rutherford, the man who discovered the nucleus of the atom, said, "The energy produced by the breaking down of the atom is a very poor kind of thing. Anyone who expects a source of power from the transformation of these atoms is talking moonshine." In 1939, Bohr made a fateful trip to the United States, landing in New York to meet his student, John Wheeler. He was bearing ominous news. Otto Hahn and Lisa Meitner had shown that the uranium nucleus could be split in half, releasing energy in a process called fission. Bohr and Wheeler began to work out the quantum dynamics of nuclear fission. Since everything in the quantum theory is a matter of probability and chance, they estimated the probability that a neutron will break apart the uranium nucleus, releasing two or more neutrons, which then fission even more uranium nuclei, which then release ever more neutrons, and so on, setting off a chain reaction capable of devastating a modern city. In quantum mechanics, you can never know if any particular neutron will fission a uranium atom, but you can compute with incredible accuracy the probability that billions of uranium atoms will fission in a bomb. That is the power of quantum mechanics. Their quantum computations indicated that an atomic bomb might be possible. 2 months later, Bohr, Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and Wheeler met at Einstein's old office at Princeton to discuss the prospects for an atomic bomb. Bohr believed it would take the resources of an entire nation to build the bomb. A few years later, Szilard would persuade Einstein to write the fateful letter to President Franklin Roosevelt, urging him to build the atomic bomb. That same year, the Nazis, aware that the catastrophic release of energy from the uranium atom could give them an unbeatable weapon, ordered Bohr's student, Heisenberg, to create the atomic bomb for Hitler. Overnight, the discussions over the quantum probability of fission became deadly serious, with the fate of human history at stake. Discussions of the probability of finding live cats would soon be replaced by discussions of the probability of fissioning uranium. In 1941, with the Nazis overrunning most of Europe, Heisenberg made a secret journey to meet his old mentor, Bohr, in Copenhagen. The precise nature of the meeting is still shrouded in mystery, and award-winning plays have been written about it, with historians still debating its content. Was Heisenberg offering to sabotage the Nazi atomic bomb? Or was Heisenberg trying to recruit Bohr for the Nazi bomb? 6 decades later, in 2002, much of the mystery over Heisenberg's intentions was finally lifted when the Bohr family released a letter written by Bohr to Heisenberg in the 1950s, but never mailed. In that letter, Bohr recalled that Heisenberg had said at that meeting that a Nazi victory was inevitable. Since there was no stopping the Nazi juggernaut, it was only logical that Bohr work for the Nazis. Bohr was appalled, shaken to the core. Trembling, he refused to allow his work on the quantum theory to fall into Nazi hands. Because Denmark was under Nazi control, Bohr planned a secret escape by plane, and he was almost suffocated due to lack of oxygen on the plane trip to freedom. Meanwhile, at Columbia University, Enrico Fermi had shown that a nuclear chain reaction was feasible. After he reached this conclusion, he peered out over New York City and realized that a single bomb could destroy everything he saw of the famed skyline. Wheeler, realizing how high the stakes had become, voluntarily left Princeton and joined Fermi in the basement of Stagg Field at the University of Chicago, where together they built the first nuclear reactor, officially inaugurating the nuclear age. Over the next decade, Wheeler witnessed some of the most momentous developments in atomic warfare. During the war, he helped supervise the construction of the Mammoth Hanford Reservation in Washington State, which created the raw plutonium necessary to build the bombs that would devastate Nagasaki. A few years later, he worked on the hydrogen bomb, witnessing the first hydrogen bomb blast in 1952, and the devastation caused when a piece of the sun was unleashed on a small island in the Pacific. But after being at the forefront of world history for over a decade, he finally returned to his first love, the mysteries of the quantum theory. Sum over paths. One of Wheeler's legion of students after the war was Richard Feynman, who stumbled on perhaps the simplest yet most profound way of summarizing the intricacies of the quantum theory. One consequence of this idea would win Feynman the Nobel Prize in 1965. Let's say that you want to walk across the room. According to Newton, you would simply take the shortest path from point A to point B, called the classical path. But according to Feynman, first, you would have to consider all possible paths connecting points A and B. This means considering paths that might take you to Mars, Jupiter, the nearest star, even paths that go backward in time, back to the Big Bang. No matter how crazy and utterly bizarre the paths are, you must consider them. Then Feynman assigned a number for each path, giving a precise set of rules by which to calculate this number. Miraculously, by adding up these numbers from all possible paths, you found the probability of walking from point A to point B given by standard quantum mechanics. This was truly remarkable. Feynman found that the sum of these numbers over paths that were bizarre and violated Newton's laws of motion usually canceled out to give a small total. This was the origin of quantum fluctuations, that is, they represented paths whose sum was very small. But he also found that the common-sense Newtonian path was the one that did not cancel out, and hence had the largest total. It was the path with the greatest probability. Thus, our common-sense notion of the physical universe is simply the most probable state among an infinite number of states. But we coexist with all possible states, some of which take us back to the dinosaur era, to the nearest supernova, and to the edges of the universe. These bizarre paths create tiny deviations from the common-sense Newtonian sense path, but fortunately have a very low probability associated with them. In other words, as odd as it may seem, every time you walk across the room, somehow your body sniffs out all possible paths ahead of time, even those extending to the distant quasars and the Big Bang, and then adds them up. Using powerful mathematics called functional integrals, Feynman showed that the Newtonian path is simply the most probable path, not the only path. In a mathematical tour de force, Feynman was able to prove that this picture, as astounding as it may seem, is exactly equivalent to ordinary quantum mechanics. In fact, Feynman was able to give a derivation of the Schrödinger wave equation using this approach. The power of Feynman's sum over paths is that today, when we formulate gut theories, inflation, even string theory, we use Feynman's path integral point of view. This method is now taught in every graduate school in the world, and is by far the most powerful and convenient way of formulating the quantum theory. I use the Feynman path integral approach every day in my own research. Every equation I write is written in terms of these sum over paths. When I first learned of Feynman's point of view as a graduate student, it changed my entire mental picture of the universe. Intellectually, I understood the abstract mathematics of the quantum theory and general relativity, but it was the idea that I am in some sense sniffing out paths that take me to Mars or the distant stars as I walk across the room that altered my world view. Suddenly, I had a strange new mental picture of myself living in a quantum world. I began to realize that quantum theory is much more alien than the mind-bending consequences of relativity. When Feynman developed this bizarre formulation, Wheeler, who was at Princeton University, rushed over next door to the Institute for Advanced Study to visit Einstein to convince him of the elegance and power of this new picture. Wheeler excitedly explained to Einstein Feynman's new theory of path integrals. Wheeler did not fully realize how utterly crazy this must have sounded to Einstein. Afterward, Einstein shook his head and repeated that he still did not believe that God played dice with the world. Einstein admitted to Wheeler that he could be wrong, but he also insisted that he had earned the right to be wrong. Wigner's friend. Most physicists shrug their shoulders and throw up their hands when confronted with the mind-bending paradoxes of quantum mechanics. To most practicing scientists, quantum mechanics is a set of cookbook rules that yields the right probabilities with uncanny accuracy. As the physicist-turned-priest John Polkinghorne has said, "The average quantum mechanic is no more philosophical than the average motor mechanic." However, some of the deepest thinkers in physics have struggled with these questions. For example, there are several ways of resolving the Schrödinger cat problem. The first, advocated by Nobel laureate Eugene Wigner and others, is that consciousness determines existence. Wigner has written that it was not possible to formulate the laws of quantum mechanics in a fully consistent way without reference to the consciousness of the observer. The very study of the external world led to the conclusion that the content of the consciousness is the ultimate reality. Or, as the poet John Keats once wrote, "Nothing ever becomes real till it is experienced." But if I make an observation, what is to determine which state I am in? This means that someone else has to observe me to collapse my wave function. This is sometimes called Wigner's friend. But it also means that someone has to observe Wigner's friend, and Wigner's friend's friend, and so on. Is there a cosmic consciousness that determines the entire sequence of friends by observing the entire universe? One physicist who tenaciously believes in the central role of consciousness is André Linde, one of the founders of the inflationary universe. For me, as a human being, I do not know any sense in which I could claim that the universe is here in the absence of observers. We are together, the universe and us. The moment you say that the universe exists without any observers, I cannot make any sense out of that. I cannot